Good morning. It looks as if everyone is ready for our hearings today. With that said, today is April 29th, 2020. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
This is the Court of Appeals calendar scheduled for today. We're conducting this via WebEx. The panel today is comprised of myself, Renee Werke. I will be the presiding judge. Judge Carol Hooten is also in attendance, as well as Judge Lucinda Jessen. We have one case that's set for oral argument and case consideration. With that said, the only remarks I have are just to remind you, if you're not speaking, to hit your mute button, and that's just so we have a cleaner record. We do have our marshal who has, it's a little bit difficult to see the timer. Can everybody see that okay? Timer should also appear on your screen. If you can't, I'll be watching the timer on my end also. Please remember the ordinary rules of appellate procedure, 15 minutes each for presentation of your case. 5 minutes is reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to exercise that option. Now, without anything else said, I'm going to turn it over to appellant counsel. Please introduce yourself and indicate who you're speaking on behalf of. The case to be addressed is A-19-1796, Kelly Jenko Prebwasser as petitioner versus the Commissioner of Public Safety respondent. You may proceed, Mr. Kohler, when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Dan Kohler, and I'm representing the appellant, Kelly Trebwasser, in this matter. When I was originally told, we had the option to either waive argument or proceed through WebEx, my initial inclination was to waive oral arguments. I think the briefs adequately cover the issues and the arguments. It's interesting to see what this is like. I expect this won't be the first time an argument is held this way, so it's nice to get that first one out of the way. But I spoke with my client and said, I'm intending to waive argument, but she wanted this argument to be held. I thought I had convinced her of why it was unnecessary. She called me the next day and said, no, I want to know that my case was argued. I said, okay, fine. And that mirrors the facts in this case. This case, among other things, emphasizes how important that attorney call is while somebody's held in custody. Because the facts of this case is that it was very contentious. But Ms. Trebwasser had an opportunity to talk to an attorney. And when she ended that phone call, she took the advice. She said, yes, I'm going to submit to this test. And the reason we're
What you're essentially arguing, if I'm hearing this right in my recollection of reading the briefs and the submissions, is can you hear me? You're arguing that the absolute rule should not be applied in this case, that your client's actions undermine the application of the absolute rule.
In part. Partially, I'm arguing that the court should not apply it as an absolute rule. There's always factors that have gone into previous cases dealing with a change of mind. And the one that comes up in the most cases is officer unavailability. The officer was on their way, somebody else, the case had finished processing it. And the court often relied on that fact in saying, nope, she stuck with her decision. I don't think that bright line of a rule saying just, you know, as soon as somebody says no, officers have no desire or need to allow them to cure that refusal. I don't know if the case law supports a rule that bright, but yes, in this case, her specific argument is that she did say yes, and then things got muddled. And because they got muddled by law enforcement, I mean, there was 15 minutes between her speaking with her attorney and the actual time to take the test. But because things got muddled in there and because things were so hot, it's frustrating that the attorney was able to get her to do the right thing, to take the test. And then it was further unnecessary conversation with law enforcement that led her to start to waffle. And once she started waffling, it just took one no at the wrong time to be treated as a refusal.
Well, can I ask you this? What is our standard of review here?
believe both parties agree that the facts are undisputed, and so that the determination as to whether this was a refusal is looked at de novo by this court.
And as I understand it, I mean, she spoke with her attorney, and then there's a 15-minute observational period. And during that period, after she said, I will take the test, then she said, then I'll refuse the test. And then she cursed. And then she said, let's skip it. And then she was asked again if she would take the test. And then she said, no, I'm not. I've already told you like an hour ago. I mean, in light of that, I mean, you're not disputing that's factually what occurred, correct?
Correct. That is what happened. Like, the argument brings it into more of a overall context where she did initially say yes. When she got off the phone with her attorney, she said, yes, I'll take it. And the way she said that made it clear. The attorney told her, yes, my legal advice that you should follow is take this test.
But if her actions are that she is refusing, I mean, if her words then and her actions are that she's refusing to take the test, doesn't that negate her prior statement that she was going to take the test?
If she didn't subsequently say, yes, I do want to take the test, yes. I mean, the argument isn't that she couldn't refuse once she initially said yes. The factual wrinkle we're highlighting in this case is that she said yes, and there was no reason for law enforcement to then press her and say, okay, so are you sure you want to take the test? Because that's what instigated the back and forth where she did say yes another couple times. She also said no a couple other times, and there was a discussion for most of the observation period. And then we hit the point where the machine is ready to go, and the officer, even though they're having this discussion, treats this question as the last time, will you take the test? And that time when she says no, it's treated as final. And there's
What case do you think is most like this situation? There's a number of cases where this has been litigated. And I mean, would you agree that this is not the Schultz case where almost immediately after saying she would not take the test, then she says, I will take the test. This is not that situation. Would you agree to that?
It's the Schultz situation only so far as she did try to cure the refusal. I could not find any published cases that would resemble this case. All of the cases seem to go toward which Judge Werke was saying is establishing a rule where somebody tries to cure their refusal, the officer's got complete discretion that's unreviewable as to whether to allow them to take that test or not. And all of the case law currently seems to establish that they'll say no and that's fine. There's dicta that we cite in our brief along the way to drawing that line, talking about the fact that, yeah, we shouldn't catch people on technicalities like that. There is a strong desire to actually obtain evidence. And if somebody says, yeah, I do want to give you that evidence, especially in an implied consent case where there is no 2-hour rule whatsoever, if she had taken that test at the Hibbing jail, there would have been no argument that it lacked a temporal connection with driving a vehicle. And then the state would have had the evidence, and Ms. Treeblosser wouldn't have faced the increased penalties that come with a refusal.
But so, I guess, counsel, if there's no case that's you can point us to that's like this, are you asking us to establish a new rule of law? And if so, what would that be?
The rule in this case would merely be that once an individual expresses the willingness or desire to submit to a test, somewhat similar to the line of cases like Raleigh, where officers can't be actively misleading, it would be officers should respect that and wait to administer the test. Don't question somebody on whether they really want to take the test or not. I mean, she could very well have waited out 15 minutes in silence and then said, nope, I'm not doing it. But that's not the facts we have here. And because her refusal came after she was repeatedly asked, are you sure didn't want to take it. I mean, granted, I'm paraphrasing the officer, but that was the effect on Ms. Treeblosser. And then the fact that she did turn around and say, no, 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 I do want to take it. It was after that last refusal. I'm trying to get the court to issue a ruling where the line isn't quite as bright as it appears to be right now. There are no other questions from the panel. I do think that the issue laid out is fairly straightforward. I would ask the court to reverse the district court in this matter on this issue and rescind the revocation of Ms. Treeblosser's license. Thank you.
Well, can I ask you one thing about the Parsons case before you stop? Parsons, there was only a 9-minute delay in the change of mind. And the court basically said that's you can't cure it after 9 minutes. I mean, so distinguishing it, I think you can distinguish it from Schultz, where it was almost immediate. Why is this case? This is a longer period than 9 minutes. So why is this case distinguishable from Parsons?
In this matter, it's less about the passage of time, and it's more about both the availability of the officer and the fact that she initially said yes, and it was at further instigated conversation by the officer that it ended up turning into a no. And the bright line at the point where the officer said, this is the question that counts. This is the time the machine is ready, where if you say no, I'm treating it as a refusal. And if you say yes, we'll go forward with the test. That's the fine line distinguishing Parsons, which was also one of several cases that highlighted, I believe, the language in Parsons was that they're encouraging officers to be flexible and disregard refusals that are promptly withdrawn. Similar to the Mossett case, where we were talking about serving that minimum public expectation by being flexible and disregarding tentative refusals. Now, taken in isolation, Ms. Treeblosser's refusal, where she swore, that was unequivocal. But in the broader context, there were many instances before that where she said yes, including the one that she said yes right after speaking to her attorney. The longer she got from that attorney consult, the easier it got for her to disregard that attorney's advice. And that's the issue in this case, and that's why I think it's appropriate for the court to rule in Ms. Treeblosser's favor.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll turn it over to respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Leah Hedman. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here on behalf of respondent today. The court asked a question about what cases were most similar to the case at issue. And I think there's really two cases that provide clear guidance for this court. Without question, the case law here is so heavily in favor of respondent's position, there would be no need for a new law or any sort of new jurisprudence on this point. It is well-established case law, all in favor. If the scales of balance are completely tipped in one side, it is directly to affirming this district court. The two cases I would mention were the Mossack case, M-O-S-S-A-K, cited in both parties' briefs, which was a 5 to 10 minutes later change of mind. The officer had completed his implied consent paperwork and was on his way out of the building. Here we know that everything was completed at the Chisholm Police Department. Appellant was placed under arrest and then transported more than 10 minutes away to a different city, to the St. Louis County Jail. And it was at the jail with the jailer present when she talked about not having having the change of mind when she got to the jail, and then again with the jailer present during the handoff from the trooper to jail staff. That's how completed the process was. In Mossack, the court rejected the application of a flexible rule, which is exactly what appellant's counsel would have you do here, is apply a flexible rule. He said, not such a bright line. I think people like to have the surety of knowing what the law is and sort of where the line is on conduct. I think it helps everybody to have a clear direction from courts, and that's why we rely on jurisprudence and court decisions. So we they rejected the application of a flexible rule and found that reversal in the circumstances of the case in Masek. The second case that I think is so on point is the Lewis case, which is a Court of Appeals case from 2007 that's also cited in our brief. And again, there was several opportunities like here where the driver was given many opportunities to test and refused. And then 11 minutes later, after being placed in handcuffs to start the transport process in Lewis to the jail, then they said, you know, I'll take the test. And Lewis, this court said our driver's clear refusal that is not immediately withdrawn constitutes a refusal and precludes a change of mind. And that's really what we have here, almost identical facts. But here it's less compelling facts because we know that the appellant was placed in handcuffs, transported to another city, and the transport time was at least 10 minutes. And then once at the jail said, you know, I'm going to take the test. So I think that's the cases that are most similar to answer your question, Your Honor, Judge Hughton, as well as, you know, whether we need to establish a new rule of law. Judge Justin, you had requested that question be answered. And I think the clear answer is no, it's just not necessary here. The law is so clear and it's been longstanding. Masek was a case from 1989, just to tell you how long this has been in place, and that this court and the Supreme Court have always dictated that the absolute rule is appropriate, even though the similar arguments by appellant making here today in Masek were rejected. So that's been the case since 1989 and should remain with this court's decision, respectfully. Also said, one of the questions about the bright line was that appellants would have you issue a line that ruling where the line isn't quite as bright. And I think that ambiguity is not something that should be encouraged by the court or its decision. I think when you start to get off a clear course of jurisprudence, then that's where people tend not to know or tend to push the boundaries and tend not to know how to act. And so I think it's appropriate to hold with the absolute rule here. And because this was even greater, more than 10 minutes, it wouldn't be appropriate in this case. Otherwise, we also don't have the facts here. There's no compelling, you know, basis by this appellant. It wasn't a closer change in mind. Schultz was a case where the absolute rule was looked at and they said, boy, you know, in Schultz, that was the determination where the implied consent advisory was read, and there's boxes that the officers check, a peace officer checks as they go through and make sure that they explain all the necessary information to a driver. And they had said, will you take the breath test? And the person, or will you take the test? And the person had just time to say yes or no, and then change their mind to yes. And so all the only passage of time was the peace officer in Schultz only had the time to check that box. That's what almost immediate means under the Schultz case. And again, Schultz is longstanding law, another case from 1989. Finally, Judge Hooten, you had asked about the Parsons case. And again, Parsons is also very important here because it's 9 minute delay. And here we know the transport time alone was 10 minutes to go from Chisholm to Hibbing. And then it was at Hibbing at the St. Louis County Jail property that the change of mind occurred. I think that appellant's counsel, his argument that this is less about the passage of time and more about the availability of the officer is really instituting a new rule. So you would be upheaving years and years of precedent. Again, 1989 is where, you know, the earliest cases I started. Because the idea is not officer availability. The implied consent statutes, again, longstanding rule, the laws remedial in nature and the laws are liberally interpreted in favor of the public interest and against the private interests of drivers. That's the State versus Januski case. It's J-U-N-C-E-W-S-K-I, 308 Northwest 2nd, 316. The cited information is from 319. And then it's some Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 1986, if I can read my writing. And because of that remedial sort of lens that we look through, it tells you that these facts are not compelling enough. There's no wrong that's being done here. If you have the opportunity to listen again to the discs in this matter, there's an audio of the information, which really gives you a flavor for the interaction between, this trooper as well as the driver here. And you have a person who is a difficult and challenging personality, but I think to sort of it sounded like appellant's counsel was kind of blaming the trooper, and it was the trooper's fault that she had changed her mind. And I just don't think that the record shows that. I think there's no really real evidence here. What you develop, if you go through the entire transcript and you go through the audio and video available to the court in the exhibits 1, 2, 3. You'll see a pattern of behavior where this is a driver who really wanted to run the show and control the process. And she herself blames the trooper. And I think that's what some of the personal attacks against the trooper and threats against the trooper are, is that she's in a circumstance that is of her own making. It's not something that the trooper did that caused her to be in custody. It's not something that the trooper did to cause her to drive while she was impaired or make the choices she made. She was able to have counsel time, and the trooper here did everything to make sure that she was able to access her cell phone and get the person that she wanted to speak with, and went kind of above and beyond, even with a tremendously difficult driver.
Well, could I ask you, I mean, there's a lot in the record, and of course the video indicates there's a lot of misconduct, I guess that took place. I mean, a lot of abusive behavior by the person against the police officer. Is that to be factored in by the court in determining whether there has been a refusal? How is that conduct, the failure to cooperate, to be is that something the court can look at in determining whether there's been a test refusal or not?
Thank you, Your Honor, for the question. I think that in this case, yes. Normally, we say bad conduct should just be sort of set aside. So that's my knee jerk. But I think in this case, you have a continuing course of behavior where she's attempting to frustrate the process over and over and over. And you have to look at the sincerity of her agreement to test. She said she would take the preliminary breath test, for example, and then began to suck on the preliminary breath test unit so as not to provide, to blow into it and provide a sample, but instead suck on the unit so that a sample could not be reached. At almost every point, once she's having, the field sobriety tests, she's not cooperative. She says she's going to do them. She doesn't do them. She tries to frustrate the process. She says she's going to test and then immediately runs over to the drinking fountain so that the 15-minute observation period has to start over. So it's actions speaking louder than words. And I think that in these particular facts, the court can take those into consideration because it's that continuing course of behavior. She says she's going to do one thing, and yet her actions show she's repeatedly frustrated the process. You have a trooper who, contrary to sort of talking her into one direction or the other, is trying to make sure that she has every opportunity to get her counsel time in, as well as to have her opportunity to test. The trooper lets the test completely start up and gives her every option to blow and says, you can blow into this. And I think the key pages and the transcript for the court to review begin really on page 29, where the attorney time ends and she states she's going to take the test and agreed to test. And then they say she agreed to take the test, that she's saying that she didn't want to, but that she was going to. And that was on page 31. And then on page 31, the same page, she says she's not blowing into anything and called the trooper another name. So I think that within the course of one page of transcript, you get a flavor for really her saying one thing, but having no intention of doing it and following through. And then the other pages, page 32, 33, are really the other aspects of that process back and forth. And then, of course, the discs provide additional information for you. But this isn't a coercion situation. I would reject that soundly. There is no evidence to support the trooper was doing anything other than trying to clarify the wishes of this driver and give her every opportunity to test if she wanted to. And after she has completed the process at the Chisholm Police Department, she is placed in handcuffs and for transport 10 minutes away, she gets to the jail, the St. Louis County Jail in Hibbing, a different city altogether. And then she says she's going to want to test there because it's after the 2-hour mark. And just one point on the 2-hour mark, the implied consent, there is case, the Rohlik case, R-O-H-L-I-K case, that says the 2-hour limit is not applicable in implied consent cases. But as this court is well aware, this is a circumstance where the DWI, criminal DWI case goes hand in hand with the implied consent case, and 2 hours is something looked at in the criminal cases. So that is something that it's, cannot be sort of parsed out here. I think that
I didn't understand that. What do you mean it can't be parsed here?
You can't say that the implied consent case, because that's what's on before the court today, somehow that you should make a different rule that ignores the 2-hour mark, that's still in play because they're not just the implied consent case at issue. The criminal DWI goes together. The same facts are make up both cases on her civil challenge to her license revocation, which we're here today, as well as the criminal DWI. And the 2-hour mark, the trooper knows that the 2-hour mark was approaching and that was a concern to say you've had 1 hour and 7 minutes total attorney time. Granted, it took some time for her, the trooper, to get her partner to get the cell phone that she's not required to supply, but that she tracked down her partner to get the cell phone, which was in her car, et cetera, to make sure she'd have that opportunity. I'm just saying his argument to say there's no 2-hour rule doesn't apply. There is a 2-hour rule. It's not in this case, but it's the criminal case, which is important as well. And so that is that's something you can't just separate, is what my point is. Based on Lewis, this court's talked about the general rule that our Supreme Court has noted, and that was in the Niflot case, and that the general rule specifically says that the general rule is that an initial refusal to submit to testing cannot be cured by a subsequent agreement to be tested. That's the Niflot versus Commissioner 369 Northwest 2nd, 512 at 517, a Minnesota Supreme Court case in 1985, and that this court, Court of Appeals, has consistently held that a subsequent change of heart does not revoke an initial refusal, even when a relatively short period of time has elapsed between the initial refusal and that reconsideration, except for an almost immediate change of mind. And that's, again, this court in Lewis, which is citing the Palm v. Commissioner case from 1995. Here,
Ms. Hatton, I need to remind you that you need to wrap up. You've run your time.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much, Your Honor. The district court here did not err in determining that appellant's subsequent change of mind more than 10 minutes after her initial refusal to test was not something that could cure her initial refusal. And we respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you. Back to appellant counsel. You have the last word.
Thank you. May it again please the court. Just two brief points on rebuttal. The first being that remedially interpreting the implied consent statute, I don't know if that supports convicting people and revoking people for refusal. I don't think it's in the public interest to ding people with refusals versus getting tests. So I'm not sure where that argument assists respondent. But my other point is along the lines of bright line rules. We do have a bright line rule when it comes to Miranda criminal cases, where if somebody invokes their right to counsel, law enforcement needs to stop any further questioning about the facts of the case. That's a bright line rule to guide law enforcement. That's similar to what we're looking for in this case. Once an individual ceases their attorney time and says, I will submit to the test, there's no need and there shouldn't be further questioning by the officer involving, so do you really want to take the test? And I guess that's what we would be looking for in this case. And that remains the distinguishing factor. It's not blaming the officer or claiming that Ms. Treewasser was coerced into refusing. That's a misstatement of our position. But it's just the fact that, especially when you are in such a contentious situation, the officer held herself together quite well, but you've still got that fact where I suspect, if we're going to speculate on motives, the officer was expecting Ms. Treewasser to refuse. And when she said yes, I think that needed to be respected to the point where the questioning did in fact cease. The facts may have ended up the same way. She still may have refused at the end of the day and then never even tried to cure it, but we won't know. But under the facts we have here, I do think it's appropriate to say, once somebody says, I'll submit to the test, let them. Don't keep questioning them, regardless of how the situation is played out. And that's why, again, we're asking the court to reverse the district court and rescind the revocation for test refusal in this case. Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys for participating in our court WebEx process. The decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. And with that said, we will all adjourn. Judges, if you wish to move up our calendar and begin the non-oral, Judge Justin, if you'll just initiate any contact. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. We can sign off.